This is WJBC This Week.
This is still a heart-wrenching time for our members and support facilities that will suffer as well through these life-altering changes.
I don't want to fight anymore. I violated a policy. I committed no crime.
There were six instances, not one instance. Six instances.
I don't know of a time when state government has been as much of a mess than it is today.
I love seeing the Cubs win, and beating the Cardinals at Wrigley is just something you can't imagine.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, United Auto Workers approve a new contract for their final months at Mitsubishi Motors. We'll look into what impact the plant closing will have on union members and their charity efforts. Bloomington's police chief responds to a plea from a fired officer to get his job back. A military family advocate discusses the impact the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have had on military families. Congressman Rodney Davis reflects on his recent trade trip to Cuba. Plus, a Radio Bloomington alum has a cameo on a hit TV show. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Nearly 2 months after the United Auto Workers labor contract at the soon-to-close Mitsubishi Motors expired, the union and automaker agreed to a new contract this week for the final few months of its operation. With a plant set to stop production on November 30th, WJBC's Terry James talked to the president of the Local 2488 for the UAW, Rod DeVary, about the plant's pending closure, what those workers are going to do next, and what will become of all of their charity efforts.
And when you guys found out the plant was closing, you knew that you had to do something to make sure that you were covered, as workers' rights are in place through the closing day.
Exactly. We have to have the language on there to protect our members.
Now, I know you do have a statement, and I'll let you go ahead and read that if you'd like to.
All right, sure. It's just, we the brothers and sisters of UAW Local 2488 have accepted the agreement that was presented to our members. Now we can focus on our futures while our time here at MMNA draws to an end. This is still a heart-wrenching time for our members and support facilities that will suffer as well through these life-altering changes we all must now face. Of course, we thank the community for their support, and we will remain positive that a new buyer presents itself and will utilize our high-quality workforce.
And, Rod, everything you said in there, absolutely right. We care so much about the workers there at Mitsubishi. And have you heard from the task force? Have they told you that there's been any good leads?
Nothing positive at this point. They are working hard. They're traveling. They are marketing our plant the best they can. Like I said, we're all hoping that somebody will be found.
I don't want to play the would have, should have game, but if the workers would have rejected this offer, what situation would we be in right
now?
Well,
we naturally would have to go back to the bargaining table. You know, I can't go any details there, but that usually would have been the next step.
In this newly approved agreement, is it very much like the old one? Are there any significant changes?
You know, I can't really give a bunch of details, but mainly the language was changed to shorten time frames, as you would expect.
So there weren't any, you can't talk about pay or any bonuses or anything like that?
I really couldn't.
Okay.
Not at this time.
And I understand that. I wanted to bring up, I don't think the community, and maybe I know a lot of people that have been beneficiaries of this realize this, but your union has been overwhelming in its generosity.
Sure.
Could you talk about that over the past 30 years, what you've done for this community?
Well, we've always supported the community. You know, as you've stated, we've done our best and always have been involved in a lot of community activities and support groups. Toys for Tots campaign is one of our larger ones. We work a lot with the United Way as well as, you know, tons of others. The veterans do such a great job, and we've just always put out for the people that have supported us as well.
And this especially, I think, is going to be hard-hitting during the Christmas season. Like you mentioned, Toys for Tots, but it was the amounts that you were giving that were helping to make or break these campaigns. And can you talk about how much money was given?
I don't have totals in front of me right now.
But on average.
But I really don't know where even to shoot a figure at you at.
We're talking tens of thousands?
Yes, I would say so.
You know, moving forward, I imagine that hurts the members that they won't be able to give like that.
Sure. Our members were very giving. I mean, they have big hearts. We always have.
And do those organizations, are they aware that they're going to be going without those donations?
Nobody's really contacted us yet, other than, you know, their support for us and their feelings. But it's just part of reality. It's what we'll have to face in the future.
Now, with Toys for Tots, and I wasn't here for the history of it, but didn't Mitsubishi workers play a large role in getting that going?
I believe so. Yeah, you know, I was at the plant most of that time. I've just now taken on the role of the president recently. But, yeah, I believe they got that rolling, and with our contributions, our membership would go out and fill a large truck for toys and stuff. So,
well, that's absolutely fantastic, and we just want to say thank you. I think from everybody in the community for what you've done.
We appreciate that.
The focus now goes on to the employees. I mean, how is everybody holding up? Are people talking about leaving the community? Just what has the talk been among the members?
Well, for the most part, you know, it's kind of somber, but getting better. I mean, as time goes on, you have to start focusing on the future. Are you going to stay here and pursue education? Are you going to move on and pursue work elsewhere? You know, there's a lot of questions that people have to face. And like you said earlier, you know, it's going to end around the holidays, and that's not always fun.
Has Mitsubishi been providing help in job seeking?
There is a program with our task force that is going to kick off. That is going to help that. There have been entities that have contacted various organizations that will pursue employment from our members.
That was UAW Local 2488 President Rod DeVary with Terry James. Days after he was cleared of felony charges in an official misconduct case, former Bloomington police officer Brenton Van Hovland publicly asked Police Chief Brendan Heffner, who fired him last year over fake traffic tickets, to hire him back.
Chief, I'm talking to you right now, man to man, father to father. I swear on my life and my children's life, I never wrote Beverly Throgmorton ticket. And the information you got in a record system that was riddled with mistakes is what I believe you guys based my termination on.
Police Chief Heffner and Assistant Chief Clay Wheeler talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Why did it become a criminal case that had to go in front of a judge and jury? And Chief, I'll ask you to start there.
Well, first of all, it was investigated internally. Discipline was administered internally. However, there were things that came up during the internal investigation that were criminal in nature that we chose to let the state police handle. So we wanted to make sure that there was no bias shown on our part. That information was taken to the state's attorney. Henceforth, it went to trial. So it was handled internally. And we chose to dismiss Mr. Van Hovland. And then the criminal part came later. What we did had no bearing. If there was never a criminal trial, it did not matter to us. He was dismissed based on the information from our internal investigation.
And the reason for his dismissal for his job before it became criminal charges was officially what?
Well, there were policy violations, obviously, just many things. Policy violations overall. You know, the documentation of the tickets. The tickets were written wrong. Attention to duty. Failure to follow orders. All of these things weighed into our decision. And obviously we have integrity issues anytime there is information that is improperly documented for self-purposes.
Speaking of documentation, Assistant Chief Wheeler, this is part of your job description, which is handling a lot of the paperwork that goes from department to department and working in traffic control, overseeing. At the time of trial, they were looking for these infamous tickets, and they didn't appear. Can you give us any insight as to where we think those tickets went?
We really don't know for sure. I mean, obviously, Mr. Van Hovland could have got hold of them when they were sitting on a desk, or a supervisor might have discarded them. The thing that came to play was originally it was thought that it was just kind of a policy violation, that he was using improper type of moving violations to write compliance tickets, to actually give them to the public, you know, the person, the offender. Through the investigation, we found out that they weren't even actually written and ever given to the offenders, which made them more, in our mind, something fraudulent, something that wasn't proper, and created the integrity issues.
So it was a victimless crime.
That would be up to the beholder, because if you're one of the people that were in an accident that had to go through a lot more problems with your insurance and so forth, because a proper ticket wasn't administered in the accident, because there were arguments about who was at fault and stuff like that, I don't think they felt like there wasn't a victim. Those people, when we had to go back and talk to them and say, did you receive this ticket that we have in our system? And they're like, well, wait a minute, a police officer wrote a ticket after my contact with him but didn't tell me about it. They don't really necessarily not feel like a victim. Now, granted, they didn't have money stolen from them or anything like that, but I don't think they're too appreciative of somebody that they would trust as a police officer doing something like that.
Do you think, in your own opinion, that if these tickets had been available for the judge and the jury to see during the criminal case, it would have made a difference in the ruling?
Oh, absolutely. I believe it would, because you're, as a juror, you have to look at a charging sheet and decide whether or not the fraud has occurred on the ticket listed or the document listed on that, and having not seen that and having to rely on that information that we were able to provide in court, you know, it definitely made them more challenging for them that way.
Chief, I've heard you say off the air that there's a lot of misinformation that came out in court that you would like to clear up. What specifically would you like to address?
I wouldn't say misinformation. I would more go along the lines of limited information. In all court proceedings, you know, the attorneys make motions, and then, you know, you're limited within a scope. And we work within the criminal justice system. We understand that. We respect it. We can be disappointed with outcomes just like anyone else. However, one thing that came to light, which really seemed to be a focus of the defense, was our traffic enforcement details when they kept talking about quotas. And as you said, we looked at them as goals. We don't have, you know, you have more than one thing for which we use to measure a person's performance. But the traffic enforcement details, first of all, I want to clear up something in regards to that. Speed can kill. That is one of the factors that the Department of Transportation has looked at as one of the contributing factors a lot of times in fatal crashes. Speed, DUI, seatbelt, a couple others. So when we are conducting traffic enforcement details, we are in essence trying to save lives and get people to slow down. Some people don't slow down until they have received a citation or two. We have conducted details out on Veterans Parkway, where I believe last week I was informed we clocked the motorists at 73 miles per hour. So if you're traveling 73 miles per hour on Veterans Parkway and someone decides to change lanes, obviously there's not a lot of time to slow down. It's not about revenue. It's about safety.
That was a Bloomington Police Chief Brendan Heffner and Assistant Chief Clay Wheeler with Susan Saunders. Congressman Rodney Davis has just returned from Cuba, where he joined Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, officials from the Illinois Farm Bureau, and others on a trade mission. Davis talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin this week.
You know, we talked about how Cuba could increase exports from America, especially Illinois, in agricultural products. But we also talked about some of the disappointment that I had. I've been there 10 years ago, and I was hoping for more changes, more privatization, and it didn't happen. And frankly, that was something that I offered up as a concern.
And how was that received?
Well, I mean, it's always received politely. Yeah. It's like you receive my insults politely too, Scott.
Yes.
But it's, you know, I honestly believe, Scott, that the Cubans, especially those in government, and remember, this is a socialist nation. This is a very controlled, top-down government on an island where the population is run by a few. I think they're more scared of the embargo being lifted than America's, you know, than America is, because that's what they have blamed for every social ill in Cuba for the last 50-plus years. And if it goes away, then maybe the Cuban people are going to start to say, huh, maybe the fact that we don't have enough food, maybe the fact that we don't have opportunities isn't America's fault. Maybe it's our leaders' fault.
Yeah, you know, and people that are against the embargo being lifted and allowing more trade, allowing tourism, is that Cuba won't benefit so much as the Castros benefiting, and the powers, those few power brokers that you speak of, would be the beneficiaries of our U.S. dollars. Is your concern there?
They have a point to a certain extent, which is why I've pushed also during this trip to ensure that Cuba remains on a path to combine their currencies. They have two currencies. One, the Cuban peso that the Cuban population gets paid in, which is abysmally low. And then they have the Cuban tourist peso called the CUC. And that was created to punish the American dollars that would be sent to Cuba so that it's always valued at about, this time it was valued about 87 cents. So every time I cashed a dollar in to buy a to buy something, I paid a 13% penalty. Mm. So there's two different economies in Cuba when it comes to the CUC and the regular Cuban peso. They're supposed to combine those in the next month. And when they do, this increased tourism that we're going to see actually then can benefit the Cuban people, because they'll be able to participate in it rather than having a what I consider a an inflated government-run peso that only the government benefits from. And the prices that tourists pay in Cuba right now are the same prices or more for what you would get back home, and you can only shop at the stores for tourists and not the regular Cuban population stores.
Wow. So as a, not a congressman, but as a husband, a father, somebody, would you consider traveling to Cuba and make it a vacation stop?
Eventually. I mean, it's a beautiful country and has the potential to be much, much more beautiful, but a lot of the buildings haven't been touched since the 50s. You'll drive around and just be amazed at the old cars that are driving next to you on the road as you're sitting in your air-conditioned bus. And we wax nostalgic, but then you got to sit back and think, those cars are on the road because those families have nothing else. They don't have any other opportunities to buy a new vehicle, so they have to fix that one. They have to be, they have to come up with parts. They have to keep them on the road to keep their family being able to travel. So those are, it's a mixed bag. I see the potential, and the potential is only going to be realized when the socialistic government is gone.
And what is the main source of income for citizens of Cuba? Is it the tourist industry?
Not at all. The tourist industry, right now, the government benefits from because of the separate Cuban tourist peso, the CUC. The Cubans are paid by the government in most cases. Now, they're moving certain sectors to what they consider privatization, or we would consider more co-ops. But it's a good step. And I would have hoped that we would have seen more of that in the last 10 years rather than the level that I've seen, that I saw just this past week. And I'm going to continue to push them. One project that was drastically different is they're developing a port that can be a partner with countries who want to partner with them when it comes to importing and exporting goods from the Cuban nation. And that was a good first step. I'll give them credit on that.
Let me rephrase my question then, because they are getting paid by the government. Where are the where are these people working? Are they on farms, hospitality industry? What's the number one or the biggest job?
The biggest
industry. Well, yeah, industry. Yeah, I want to. I'm parsing my words because it is a communist country.
I wish I could give you an easy answer, Scott, but I can't.
Okay.
I can tell you in certain regions, it depends on where you live. When we went out into the rural areas, being a part of the agricultural co-op run by those who were loyal to the government, it was brought up that maybe it was the CIA's fault that they don't have as much food as they used to have in the past, and I just about lost it when that happened. But we saw out there very poor rural area conditions, but everybody in that co-op worked for the agricultural cooperative. They had four tractors for an entire community, and those tractors were 40 years old and Russian built. I mean, it just shows you the resources they've been lacking. And frankly, they blame the American embargo for all of these ills. And the Cuban people have been told this their entire life. Now you go into the cities, you see folks work at hospitality. There are hotels where people are vacationing from all the world, and they're working there. The last day we went and toured a cigar factory, and frankly, if I ever smoked cigars, I'd probably be less apt to do so after I went there.
Ooh, why do you say that?
Oh, it's just what we would consider a factory versus what they consider a factory is a totally different view and totally different reality. You have individuals that come in or are getting trained on how to roll cigars, and these individuals, they pass their apprenticeship program. They have a job. That's one of the manual labor jobs that, according to our guide, was highly sought after. But the conditions there are conditions that you would see in a third world country.
That was Congressman Rodney Davis with Scott Laughlin. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Recent studies have shown alarming rates of domestic violence among those who have served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly those who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Stacy Bannerman became a military family advocate after she became a victim herself. She wrote the book Homefront 911, How Families of Veterans Are Wounded by Our Wars. And she talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week to mark Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Domestic violence is an overlooked problem in general, but when it comes to the families of veterans, it appears that there is a much higher risk.
There certainly is a much higher risk. And that risk, however, I want to be very, very clear, is directly tied to the consequences of combat service, and specifically combat-related PTSD. There is a strong and direct correlation between the development of combat PTSD and the likelihood that a service member or a veteran will commit at least one severe act of intimate partner violence or domestic violence. That correlation is so strong that a Yale study that was conducted in 2010 found that combat vets with PTSD are responsible for approximately 21% of all instances of domestic violence in this country, which when you think about the fact that combat vets or veterans make up approximately 20% of suicide rates in this country, it starts to make sense. The reality is that this is one of the ways that the war comes home. But not talking about it doesn't make anyone safer.
You say over 20% of domestic violence, that is tracked. You know, a lot of people don't report domestic violence, so there's probably a lot of things going out there that the numbers can't even reveal. But that's a very high number when you consider such a small percentage of the population are combat veterans.
Precisely. And again, I want to be so clear that this isn't all veterans and it's not all combat veterans. But again, what we know is that combat service, especially combat vets with PTSD, it's just a very high risk factor. And given what combat is about, and given the characteristics of post-traumatic stress, the hypervigilance, the irritability, the anger, you know, those kinds of things, we shouldn't be surprised that there's a significant uptick in the rates of domestic violence. However, that does not mean that there should be silence about that domestic violence at home. The United States military has got a zero-tolerance policy on domestic violence in family members, and this is true of myself. When my husband strangled me, I didn't report it because he wasn't like that before he went to war.
We're talking to Stacey Bannerman, veterans family advocate and the author of the book Homefront 911, How Families of Veterans Are Wounded by Our Wars. You referred, Stacey, to the violence in your home. Your husband strangled you. Talk a little bit about what happened to him, because the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder and the effects of being in combat zones seem to really not only change his behavior, but his personality from what you were used to.
Very much so. And the hallmarks of veteran intimate partner violence are so different from the typical trajectory of domestic violence. There was that one incident, isolated incident, very severe. Veteran domestic violence tends to be very severe. And there's no escalation. There is an explosion of violence.
It's very difficult for partners to get out of domestic violence situations under any circumstance. There are a lot of barriers that keep people from being able to leave that situation, to wanting to leave that situation, to remedy it. But I think it would have to be particularly difficult for military spouses, because it's probably pretty apparent that a lot of the situations that have come about, those explosions of violence, is something that isn't their fault, but yet the spouses and the children are there in that situation and they are suffering. So how do you advise spouses who are living in this environment where they have a veteran who is maybe abusive, who is causing a great deal of stress on the family? How do you advise them to try to make a break or make a change?
Well, as one veteran's caregiver said to me when I came clean about what had been happening and what I had been experiencing at home, she said to me, "You don't have to set yourself on fire to keep someone else warm." And that was such a powerful, powerful statement for me, and one I've had to repeat to myself a number of times. Let's keep in mind, however, that it's more difficult for a military family or military spouse, particularly, and veterans caregiver to make that break for some of the reasons you've mentioned, but also because of reasons that are unique to the military spouse community. Military spouses are much likelier to be unemployed or underemployed than civilian spouses. Military spouses, they sacrifice, especially with the churn cycle of these wars over the last, 12 plus years, they sacrifice their careers for their service member. They move frequently, often losing teaching licenses, license to practice law in that state, those kinds of things in the process. A lot of sacrifices are made by that military spouse and that military family to keep that service member in uniform. And one of the sacrifices that is made for a lot of military spouses is that of their career. Veterans caregivers may begin taking care of their veteran, and the vast majority of veterans caregivers are the spouse. Nearly all veterans caregivers are women, and while many of them may have a job when they first begin taking care of their veteran, as I did, you will find over time as the veteran's needs and conditions worsen, which it often does, that their work hours are reduced or they have to quit work altogether. Now, the VA's got a caregiver program that provides a very, very modest stipend for the caregivers, but we are financially tied to our service member. We are financially tied to our caregiver. We have sacrificed our careers, and so there's a significant financial barrier to leaving.
That was military family advocate Stacey Bannerman with Steve Fast. WBNQ and WJBC alum Mason Schrader is now the host of a morning radio show in Chicago with a fellow Radio Bloomington alum, Zach Hosley, known as Remy, on Big 95.5 FM. This week, Mason crossed over into television with an appearance on the ABC hit show Nashville. Here's a clip.
Do you read the rags, Juliet?
No, not if I can help it.
Neither do I, but for the listening audience, this is a tabloid shot of your husband and a mystery woman. This kind of stuff probably happens all the time, right? People taking pictures of you and your family everywhere you go.
And making false allegations like this one, it happens all the time.
And Mason talked with WJBC's Dan Sweeney this week.
You worked here for, well, 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to St. Louis, and now you're in Chicago, and you get a phone call from the people who are the, I'm guessing, producers of Nashville. How did you get hooked up with being on the show tonight?
It's a real stretch for me being, a radio guy who, talks to celebrities sometimes and gets told what questions to ask. They said she's going to be in the scene in a radio station in Chicago. Can you be you? And it's not much of a stretch, to be honest, but it was pretty cool. They called and they wanted somebody who does this, and myself and Remy, who also grew up in central Illinois there in Normal, went to ISU and worked at State Farm for a bit there, and he's my co-host up here. We both did an audition, and they said, we can pay one of you, which is always the deal, right?
Wait a minute. They sound like radio people now.
It did sound familiar. Like I said, it wasn't much of a stretch, but no, it was awesome. I went to Nashville back in August and shot a scene with Hayden Panettiere, and actually in the beautiful Nash FM studios there. And if you see the scene, it's beautiful studios. You can tell it's fake. It's not a real radio studio.
You mean there aren't empty pop cans sitting around in the back and things
right.
like that?
Everything worked. It was crazy. It was beautiful.
So they tell you that you do your audition. What was an audition like to do a segment on a big show like Nashville?
Well, and you know, again, it was kind of like we do in the scene what we're doing in real life. So we're talking, I have a morning show in Chicago on a brand new country station there. And so we're talking to these country artists sometimes. And they had us kind of record. They gave us the script. We kind of recorded this audition and sent it to them. And the next thing you know, I'm in a trailer in Nashville and getting makeup sitting next to Hayden Panettiere.
Wow. And I say wow for many on many different levels there, that it, you know, it happens that quickly and you get to Nashville. Are you a fan of the show?
You know, I had watched it in the first couple of seasons, you know, working in country music like I do, and I hadn't followed it lately, but there are some other people, some other radio hosts from around the country that they've had on the show do some guest spots, and it's great. I was honored. It was a lot of fun. And you know, I was going to have a watch party tonight, and then they released like my entire scene online, the whole thing online now. But it's pretty cool that like I didn't end up on the editing room floor. You know what I mean? Made it into the actual show.
So if you follow Nashville, I'll try to bring people up to speed here, and then I want to figure out what it was like to sit in that studio with the cameras rolling, things like that. Hayden Panettiere is Juliet Barnes on the show, mm-hmm. and she's a person that has certainly had her share of ups and downs, and she had a baby, then she has this postpartum problem. She breaks up with her husband, who wants to file for divorce. Like I said, this was a soap opera at night, which... Interestingly enough, a story just came out yesterday, but that she in real life had a baby and she's having postpartum problems anyway. But anyway, so she's the bad girl in the show, so to speak. And Connie Britton is the counterbalance to that. So you go to Nashville, you're sitting in makeup, and in walks Hayden Panettiere. What's that like?
Well, you know, you definitely nailed it with it is a soap opera at night. That's the description I've been giving to everyone for sure, because if you watch it tonight, you'll understand. It's a lot of drama, but you know, she's great. I didn't, you know, talk a lot with her. You know, you never know. Can you? I'm no TV star, so I don't feel comfortable in a makeup chair or sitting across. I'm like, can I make eye contact with you? I don't know, but she was great. You know, there's a part in the show where she was talking about her character, and yeah, Julia's gone through. Unfortunately, it appears some of the stuff that she's going through in real life,
right?
At the same time, and so it's illustrated in the scene, and we kind of talked about it. The director of the episode is actually a super famous '80s TV mom, Joanna Kearns.
Yeah, heck yeah.
So she was on the set, you know, and there's a scene where they're saying things like, we want you to cut to commercial, and you probably know working in radio is something we don't exactly say is, we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. It's kind of cliche, and I'm like, you know, I said to him, I probably wouldn't say that, but Hayden Panettiere was quick to let me know that this isn't reality. And I should probably stick to the script.
Whoa!
She was all joyful. She was. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to cast the wrong impression. It was all in fun, and we all laughed about it. But she was right.
That's incredible. This is Mason Schrader, who was on WBNQ in the morning for a long time and is now in Chicago doing some country music radio and doing really well at it. Congratulations on that, Mason. But you just finished a segment on Nashville with Hayden Panettiere. And so you're sitting in the chair and the cameras, is it a one camera shoot or do they have multiple cameras? Because some TV shows just do one cameras.
Yeah, it was intimidating. They had, you know, two cameras on me and two cameras on her and mm-hmm. one that was kind of moving around. So we did the scene like three or four times, and then they would say, switch, and I had no idea what was going on, but everybody stood up and walked out, so I followed them. and they were moving cameras to the other side so they could get the other angle, and then we'd roll through the scene again and shoot it another four or eight times or whatever it was. And I mean, it's looking back now, it was so surreal to go around. I mean, they're beautiful studios. And then, you know, Joanna Kearns is telling me how I should be saying things like, your baby daddy is pictured here, you know, the dramatic things that are in the show. And then, you know, Hayden Panettiere, who I'm kind of a nerd. I watched Heroes on NBC and she was on that. And I was like, you're great in Heroes. And, you know, I'm kind of humbled to be here. It's just so surreal looking back.
Was she nice to you? Was she approachable, I guess? Could you have any conversation with her outside of what you were doing?
We joked a little bit on the set there as they were switching cameras and things like that. Like I said, I was like, you looked at these studios. I said, you've done radio tours before. You know, sometimes celebrities go out and they go into radio stations. I said, you've never been in one that's this nice, right? Because I work in radio.
Right.
I've never been in one that's this nice. But, you know, it was fun, and it was real. It made me really comfortable, you know, and I'm super nervous as not an actor going into this thing, going, where am I? And they made it great. Everybody on the set was great.
That was Radio Bloomington alum Mason Schrader with Dan Swain. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. About 950 union members have a new contract for their final months at Mitsubishi Motors. Members of the UAW Local 2488 voted overwhelmingly on a new contract. Union Local President Rod DeVary tells WJBC's Terry James, workers can now focus on their futures.
This is still a heart-wrenching time for our members and support facilities that will suffer as well through these life-altering changes we all must now face. Of course, we thank the community for their support.
In a statement, Mitsubishi says the agreement sends a clear message. The organization is appreciative of the employees' commitment. The McLean County Health Department says Normal Community High School is the latest in the area with an outbreak of mumps. The health department says that means three or more cases have been reported at the school. As of Friday, 36 cases have been confirmed in the county, with more test results pending. The ages of people who have tested positive range from 15 to 54 years old, the heaviest concentration between the ages of 15 and 20. If your child is in the sixth grade or older and they have not been vaccinated against meningitis, they are not being allowed into school. Nearly 200 students attending schools in the Bloomington Normal area are being told to stay home until they are vaccinated. McLean County Health Department Clinic Supervisor Trish Cleary says the clinic is backed up with appointments for various vaccinations until November.
We are keeping a list here of people that we have made appointments for, should cancellations happen in our schedule, we will call the people on our list to try and get them worked in sooner.
Meningitis starts with a rash and flu-like symptoms and can lead to death. Former Governor Jim Edgar says his advice to Governor Rauner would be to focus on passing a budget, not his so-called turnaround agenda.
I've been around state government for 47 years, and I don't know of a time when state government has been as much of a mess than it is today.
Edgar told political science students at the University of Illinois Chicago the TV ads bought by Rauner's campaign committee created a poor atmosphere for budget negotiations. And the Chicago Cubs eliminated the St. Louis Cardinals this week to move on to the National League Championship Series. WJBC's Joe Ragusa was at Pub 2 in Normal to get reaction.
This was the moment Cubs fans knew the team was moving on to the NLCS. ISU student Alex Kaluza is excited about the Cubs' win.
I love seeing the Cubs win, and beating the Cardinals at Wrigley is just something you can't imagine. You can't imagine.
From Pub 2 in Normal, Joe Ragusa, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Now we take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Illinois State University President Larry Dietz and Normal Mayor Chris Koos will light up the trees in Uptown Normal to kick off homecoming week at ISU. Also Monday, Illinois State men's basketball holds its media day, and the women on Tuesday. Also Tuesday, Unit 5 will hold the first of its public strategic planning sessions, and the McLean County League of Women Voters will release the results of a study on affordable housing in the county. On Friday, Willie Chambers of Bloomington is scheduled to be sentenced for his role in the beating death of a homeless man at O'Neill Park in June of last year. And on Saturday, it's Illinois State's homecoming parade and football game against Western Illinois. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.